This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Will we be safer after Saddam Hussein? What is the role of oil in this war? How will the war affect the Middle East peace process? And why did France take such a hard line against the United States? These are some of the questions I discussed with Christopher Dickey. He's been Newsweek's Middle East regional editor since 1993 and is also the magazine's Paris bureau chief. His books include a memoir about his late father, the writer James Dickey. We called Christopher Dickey in Jordan. Christopher Dickey, you're speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Why are you in Jordan?
Well, Jordan is a good listening post for what goes on in Iraq, what goes on in Israel and the occupied territories, and what goes on sort of across the Arab world. It touches on lots of different countries and lots of different issues. And I spent the first Gulf War here, and it was a very good place to be, so I thought it would be a good place to be this time around. And eventually, I think we'll have a straight shot into Baghdad or the siege of Baghdad from here.
So can you give us an overview of what you are hearing in terms of reaction to the war?
Well, I think the important thing for people in the United States to understand is that this war has almost no credibility as far as the rest of the world is concerned, certainly not the Arab world. I think that the media coverage that people are seeing coming out of the United States on CNN and the other networks and in the American press just doesn't fit with the perceptions that exist here among Arabs, among Muslims, and in fact among most Europeans. And I think that that's going to lead to a greater and greater sort of disconnect between the administration and the American public and this part of the world that could prove very dangerous and a real long-term liability.
There's a lot of Iraqi refugees living in Jordan, about 400,000. What's the reaction of the Iraqi refugees in Jordan?
Well, a lot of them are going back, not 400,000. There are about 350,000, 400,000 Iraqis who live here. They're not all refugees. A lot of them are here because the economic opportunities are better. They're not here as political refugees. Some are. I've been talking to a lot of them. Some 4,000 or 5,000 have gone back to Iraq since the beginning of the war. It's one of the interesting things here. There's been no refugee flow out of Iraq whatsoever. All the flow has been back into Iraq by people who want to go be with their families, help defend their homes, and in some cases, many say they want to go help defend Saddam Hussein.
You're in Jordan. Do you think the King of Jordan is worried about his future in the face of this war?
Well, absolutely. I mean, for the King of Jordan, who's very quietly helping the United States, but extensively helping the United States in this effort, for the Saudis, who are doing the same thing, for virtually every regime that is in any way connected with the United States, I think this is not only an embarrassing but dangerous situation. You have to remember that a couple of weeks ago, nobody would have given a plug nickel for Saddam Hussein. People didn't support him. They didn't like him. They saw the horrors that he represented. They didn't particularly like the idea of this war. In fact, many, many were opposed to it. But they didn't like him. Now, he emerges as a kind of a hero, standing up to the United States, holding fast against an American onslaught. You know, this war has already gone on longer than the 67 war that Israel fought against the whole Arab world. And it looks like it's going to go on for many weeks more. And this is the superpower, the greatest power on earth, bringing an enormous amount of force to bear on a country of 24 million people that has been under boycott and embargo for the last 12 years and has had its army decimated in several wars. So to see the Iraqis standing up at this point, to see Saddam standing up, is a source of inspiration and pride and also of growing anger in the Arab and Muslim world. And it is really not improving the image of the USA in these parts.
Even though Saddam Hussein is a dictator, a brutal dictator, a sadistic dictator, and everybody knows that, and even though Saddam Hussein isn't a pious Muslim, he is still being looked up to for standing up to the United States?
Sure, because the United States is the United States, and also because this is an invasion. Nobody in this part of the world uses the word liberation. You know, President Bush can repeat that again and again as much as he wants, so can Tony Blair, but the fact is nobody believes it. Everybody here sees this as an invasion and the beginning of an occupation of a sovereign Arab state. And I'll tell you, it's more nuanced than that, too. I mean, what you hear again and again from Iraqis, who can obviously speak more freely here than they can in Iraq, and many of whom are deeply opposed to Saddam, is, look, we couldn't get rid of Saddam, but we're glad the Americans are getting rid of Saddam, because we know then we can get rid of the Americans. Not that they'll leave, but the Americans are a lot easier to terrorize and a lot easier to eliminate and a lot easier to get rid of than Saddam Hussein. So none of that bodes particularly well for administration policy or for the future of the United States in this region.
My guest is Christopher Dickey. He is the Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Editor for Newsweek. He's speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. The Bush administration indicated that they thought that when the U.S. military came into Iraq, the military would be greeted as liberators. That has not visibly turned out to be the case. Why do you think we haven't? Why do you think people haven't been running out in Iraq and greeting the tanks and greeting the soldiers as liberators?
Well, I think you have to step back, for starters, and sort of understand that people like Kanan Makiya and Ahmed Chalabi, these sort of leading exiles of people that certainly the Pentagon listened to, or the civilians in the Pentagon listened to very closely, have been preaching the same line for years. And that line is, the Iraqi people hate Saddam Hussein, they detest Saddam Hussein, and therefore they will love the Americans when they arrive. Well, it is true that the Iraqi people do detest Saddam Hussein, but they do not love the Americans. And that is a huge miscalculation. Now, in terms of what's actually happening on the ground, Saddam has been very, very smart in the way he distributed his thugs throughout the country. And instead of concentrating all his ability to intimidate in Baghdad the way he used to do, what he's done is to take Saddam's Fedayeen and some members of the Republican Guard and the Special Guard and spread them around the country so that their presence is felt in every sort of medium-sized city and even small town in Iraq. And people are afraid of Saddam and afraid of these people, and fear is a motivating factor with them. I don't think it's the only factor, but it certainly is important. Saddam's ability to terrorize his population has a kind of a mythical aspect to it. It's built into the population. You could almost say it's genetic after 35 years of Ba'ath Party rule, with Saddam either in the background or at the head of the government. And people are not going to believe that Saddam is not in power or not able to retaliate against them until they know he's dead. I mean, really dead. If they could dip their hands in his blood, maybe they would be convinced, and that would be the kind of thing that certainly has happened in Iraq before.
The Bush administration has given two main reasons for the war. One is to liberate the Iraqi people, and the other is to find the weapons of mass destruction and do away with them. You have a column on the Newsweek website suggesting that we might not necessarily be safer after Saddam Hussein. Your concern, and this is something you've been picking up from intelligence experts, is that there might be individual operatives who will have access to weapons of mass destruction.
Sure.
What kind of scenarios have you been hearing are possible? Yeah.
Look, this is a really tightly controlled regime where all the scientists were under the fist, if you will, of Saddam and his security apparatus. And they're very smart people. They were able very nearly to create an atomic bomb. They created very sophisticated chemical and biological weapons programs. And they have expertise that is marketable in a world where proliferation is rampant around the globe. Now, does it seem likely? I mean, this is the position of many in the intelligence business. It doesn't seem likely to them that all those scientists are going to be rounded up effectively by this invasion. Many of them will have left the country already. Many of them will leave during the course of the fighting, one way or another. Many of them will stay but will not be identified. It's very, very hard to track down the specific identities of people in Iraq. And as a result, as they have the chance to go their own way, they will go on to a market, go into a market or into a marketplace for weapons of mass destruction that's already very, very well developed, except they'll be freelancers. Very hard to trace, very hard to control, and very, very dangerous. This is what we saw with the breakup of the Soviet Union. This is what we saw with the demise of several regimes in Eastern Europe. And this is what many in the intelligence field think we will see with Iraq. So, no, it probably will not make this a world of safer place, no.
I want to quote something that you wrote recently in Newsweek. You wrote, you know, Iraq is not just another dictatorship. It's one of the last truly totalitarian states in the tradition of Germany under Hitler or the Soviet Union under Stalin. And you say, when whole countries are run like prisons, the population tends to act the way inmates do in an uprising. They're less interested in liberation at first than in settling scores, slaughtering their guards and each other. When totalitarianism ended in Yugoslavia, the country crumbled into bloody pieces. What are some of your concerns about Iraq after the war?
Well, just that. I think that the United States will have a terribly difficult role trying to keep Iraq together, and frankly, I don't think it will be able to do it. The centrifugal forces inside Iraq, not just among the Kurds, the Sunni, and the Shia, which now everybody in America is probably familiar with, but within these different communities, Shia against Shia, Sunni against Sunni, tribe against tribe, Kurdish against Kurdish, all these are intensely felt feuds that are briefly united either by the terrorism of Saddam and his iron control over the country, or temporarily united in opposition to Saddam. But when it comes to converting that into a single polity that works, that functions, that is even remotely democratic, the chances are very, very slim indeed. And the commitment required of the colonial power that would try and institute that democracy is a very long-term commitment. Nobody thinks that the United States really will commit itself to 5, 10, 15, 20 years of occupying Iraq. And if it does, it's going to find itself at war with the rest of the region and much of the rest of the world.
One of the issues you've been writing about is big oil. You know, a lot of people are wondering, does this war have anything to do with oil? And if so, how does oil come into play? In an article you wrote, you said that big oil wants to regain influence over the Middle East oil fields from which Western companies were expelled four decades ago. What do you think are the hopes of big oil now?
Well, I think they vary. I think, first of all, that the idea that Iraq is suddenly going to become our Saudi Arabia, a sort of wholly owned oil subsidiary of the United States that can counteract the other forces in the global oil market, is deeply misleading. And I think people who look at that as a positive thing should rethink what they're doing. I think as far as the oil companies are concerned, clearly they see a chance to get in on the ground floor in an enormous market, particularly with what are called production sharing agreements, something that's very rare in the Middle East and in the really big oil-producing states, but which has come to be sort of accepted practice among the more corrupt and backward nations of Africa and to some extent in Latin America. Production sharing agreements essentially mean that the people who develop the field, the companies who develop the field, are able to book the proven reserves of these oil fields as assets on their bottom line, and it increases their stock price, makes them much more valuable companies, guarantees their supply of oil to the market, and so on. But it's always been viewed as a tremendous infringement of sovereignty in this part of the world, and certainly since the great wave of nationalizations in the 1970s, that sort of thing has been absolutely unacceptable. So we'll see if the oil companies are willing or able, rather, to get that kind of deal with whoever they have to deal with in Iraq. But then the question comes, who are they going to deal with in Iraq? Are they going to be dealing with the occupation government, with Iraqis appointed as administrators and bureaucrats by Tommy Franks and his assistants? Is that a credible contract with no independent constitution, no independent laws? Right now, the only company, the American company, not the only one, but the American company that is making a huge amount of money out of this war already and will be making even more is Halliburton and its subsidiary, Kellogg Brown & Root, which, of course, was formerly run by Dick Cheney.
So how are Halliburton and Kellogg Brown & Root making money from the war?
Well, they've already gotten initial contracts to put out the fires in southern Iraq, and they are first in line to get the contracts to rebuild the infrastructure of Iraq's oil industry. Now, those contracts probably will be signed by some kind of client Iraqi government under the military administration. but they don't require the kinds of investments that development of the big oil fields do. Because to develop the big oil fields, you're talking many tens of billions of dollars. And to do that, I think even Exxon and some of the other big oil companies are going to be reticent to go in unless they have a much clearer legal framework than they are likely to have for another 2 or 3 years at the soonest.
Is the fact that the Vice President, Dick Cheney, used to be the CEO of Halliburton, and Halliburton is getting huge contracts as a result of the war in Iraq, is that something that's being talked about in Jordan or in other Arab countries, or you know, in the media there?
Oh, absolutely. It's being talked about all the time. The minute that these initial contracts, which are not the you know, enormous contracts, but the first contract showing that Halliburton has got its foot in the door, the minute those were initialed and the word went out, it was all over the Arab press, because it just convinces everybody that this is a grab for oil by a bunch of very cynical people in the American administration. I don't think it is, but that's the way it looks to the people out here, and in fact, that's the way it looks to an awful lot of Europeans as well.
Shortly before the war started, like a few weeks before the war, President Bush said that he wanted to table the Middle East roadmap until after the resolution of Iraq. But much more shortly before the war, just a couple of days or so before the war started, he said that he was willing to go forward with the Middle East roadmap, apparently at the insistence of Tony Blair. How do you think President Bush's willingness to go forward now with the Middle East roadmap is playing in the Middle East to Israelis and to Palestinians?
Well, I don't think that President Bush really has any credibility in the peace process whatsoever. I think Prime Minister Sharon in Israel sees Bush as the best friend he's ever had, and he says as much all the time. And if that's the case, it's hard to believe that he really expects Bush to put a lot of pressure on him to shut down the illegal settlements in the occupied territories and withdraw, which is really what the roadmap says. In fact, I was just going over the roadmap in considerable detail earlier today, and it is certainly the most progressive plan for peace in the Middle East, and in many ways the most practical that's ever existed. But the Bush administration has allowed the Israeli government to stall and to stall and to stall some more. And, of course, part and parcel of this is the Bush administration's own reluctance to address any of these issues seriously until after the 2004 elections. You'll notice that it's a three-year horizon, which takes us conveniently to 2005 before any really tough decisions have to be made. And so as a result, I think there's just no confidence. But even as bad as the situation is, the Arab government and the new Palestinian government that's taking shape are trying to work within this framework and within this plan, and some good things are already coming out of it, not least of which is that new Palestinian government. Arafat is rapidly being shouldered aside in a way that would have been inconceivable a couple of years ago, and that is probably to the good over the long run.
What are some of the things within the Middle East roadmap that make you think it's one of the more, what was the word you used to describe it?
Well, it's one of the most progressive and ambitious in terms of the creation of a Palestinian state, a viable Palestinian state, which is something that the Bush administration has said it supports again and again and again in really unequivocal terms. Now, the problem is implementation. That's where the devil is in these details. But on paper, even before the roadmap, the Bush administration goes much, much further than any previous administration in saying that it supports a viable Palestinian state, not Palestinian self-determination, not an entity, not a something or other, but a viable Palestinian state living side by side in peace with Israel. And the roadmap embraces that idea and advances it along the lines not only of UN resolutions, but of other international texts, including the Arab resolution that came out of the Beirut summit almost a year ago that promises peace with the whole Arab world if Israel will embrace a two-state solution that, in fact, includes withdrawal from virtually all of the territories occupied in 1967.
What are your impressions of the new Palestinian prime minister?
Abu Mazen is a very colorless character in a field of very colorful ones. He has been the steady player. He's the man that people trust when they talk to him. Arafat has occasionally had the good sense to send Abu Mazen out to negotiate with Israelis and others when serious work needed to be done. So he's certainly a well-known quantity. He was involved with the Oslo talks and so on. And I think there's a general feeling among many Israelis and certainly among the Europeans and the Americans directly concerned with the peace process that he's a man they can deal with. Now, whether he has the charisma to pull the Palestinian people behind him and to win support among the Palestinian masses, if you will, and the Arab masses, because no Palestinian issue is strictly limited to the Palestinians, that's another question, but we'll see. At least he's somebody you can talk to and have a sensible conversation. Any of us who've ever interviewed Arafat know that it's the most futile exercise in circular debate imaginable. And I think people are just fed up, and they want to. Anybody who wants to move ahead would rather have the straight-talking Abu Mazen than the endlessly deceptive Arafat.
One of the big controversies surrounding how to go about dealing with Saddam Hussein has been this. Should the Middle East peace be dealt with first, and then would it be a lot easier to deal with Saddam Hussein? Or should Saddam Hussein be dealt with first, and then would it be a lot easier to deal with peace in the Middle East? Why are these two issues so interconnected?
I think you have to understand everything within the general concept of the humiliation of the Arabs. Arabs and Muslims generally, but certainly Arabs around the world, feel a collective sense of humiliation because of their history over the last couple of hundred years. First at the hands of the Ottomans, and later after all the betrayals by the colonial powers in the wake of World War I, and then the successive defeats at the hands of Israel, and also the oppression and humiliation at the hands of their own leaders. And there's also a sense in the Islamic world of there's this very strong sense of justice. In Europe, when they do polls in the Muslim community in Europe and then outside the Muslim community and say, what does Islam mean to you? Non-Muslims tend to say terrorism or fanaticism or things. We use words like that. Muslims tend to say justice. There's a sense of fairness and equity in Islam that's very important. And the sense that the creation of Israel in the 30s and 40s, and then, of course, the War for Independence, was profoundly unjust, is just deeply, deeply rooted in Arab and Muslim society. What people see now is that this one government, as brutal and thuggish as it is, but the one government that stood up to the United States and stands up to the United States, is now the object of a full-scale invasion. And, you know, you can't walk down the street here and talk to anybody who doesn't draw some sort of parallel with Iraq, who doesn't sort of say, look, you invade Iraq to get rid of weapons of mass destruction, and yet nobody wants to talk about the weapons of mass destruction in Israel. You invade Iraq because it doesn't abide by UN resolutions, and nobody wants to talk about Israel ignoring UN resolutions. These are the kinds of parallels that are made again and again and again in the Arab world. Are they just arguments? I don't think so, but that's maybe the subject for another day. What they are is they're convincing to Arabs and they're convincing to Muslims, and that's something that has to be dealt with as a matter of public diplomacy and of fundamental policy by any American administration. And this administration, while it has paid lip service to these notions and even on paper taken a very ambitious and forward-looking position, has been unwilling to do anything to implement these policies in concrete terms. And that's why there's such a deep, deep, really a fundamental mistrust of Washington.
Because within the Arab world, perceptions of the war in Iraq are tied to their perceptions of the Middle East, is the war in Iraq helping to fuel anti-Semitism?
I don't think anti-Semitism could get a whole lot worse in the Middle East than it already is in the Arab and Muslim
world. Isn't that
world.
Good news?
I think perhaps it is helping to fuel some anti-Semitism in Europe, not only among the Muslim community, but among many Europeans who feel that this is a policy being driven driven by Israel for Israel, or more to the point, driven by the Likud Party for the Likud Party's vision of the world, and that it is extremely dangerous. When I was at the protest rallies in February in Britain, when there were more than a million people in the streets of London protesting against this what was an oncoming war, and I can tell you it was a sea of Palestinian flags. And a lot of those Palestinian flag wavers were not Arab and were hostile to Israel. And it was sometimes hard to see where hostility to Israel and Zionism ended and hostility to Jews began. It was it's not a happy situation, and I think it's going to get a lot worse. I think it's probably fortunate that even though Israel is killing sometimes 6 to 10 Palestinians a day, and the world doesn't seem to be paying a lot of attention to it, many people thought that its actions, that Sharon's actions, would be even more dramatic once the war began against Saddam. And he seems to have acted with, by his standards, some restraint. But if you start to see really major incursions by Israel into the Palestinian territories, even more extensive than you've seen already, I think you're going to see a huge amount of anger, not only in the Muslim world, but in Europe.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying that anti-Sharon sentiment is getting generalized more and more into anti-Semitism.
Well, I think there's that risk, yes. I mean, I think that, you know, people shade these things very quickly on every side of any debate. I mean, for instance, until very, very recently, it was very little anti-American sentiment as such, that is, sentiment against Americans, in France. There was a huge hostility to the policies of the Bush administration. In America, you know, anti-Chirac sentiment instantly became anti-French sentiment. People stopped drinking French wine, which has absolutely nothing to do with Chirac's policy on this war. And I think, you know, when you've got emotions running high, it's very easy to see that there is going to be a tendency for anti-Sharon, anti-Likud policy positions to very quickly shade over into anti-Israeli positions, and then, because Jewish communities are generally very supportive of Israel, into anti-Jewish positions. Is that anti-Semitism in the classical sense? Perhaps not, but it's ugly nonetheless.
Yesterday at the UN, France's Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin said that these times call for a renewed close and trusting relationship between his country and the U.S. But France not only continues to disagree with the Bush administration about the war, France wants the UN to play a large role in running post-war Iraq, a plan that the Bush administration remains opposed to. Let's get back to our interview with Christopher Dickey, Newsweek's Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor. I asked him about how the rift between France and the U.S. grew so big. What was at stake for France when it took such a strong stand against the war in the Security Council?
France's position has to be understood in a couple of different lights. First of all, the position taken by Chirac at the Security Council and in his general discourse on this war is a position that is not difficult to justify unless you're in the United States. It's a position that's congruent with the vast majority of opinion, not only in France, but all over Europe, including in Britain and in Italy and in Spain, where the governments are backing U.S. policy. In that sense, he took a righteous position in line with public opinion and public sentiment. But it's possible to take a righteous position sometimes for the wrong reasons or for reasons that are not absolutely made clear to the public. And I think that there's very little question that Chirac and especially his foreign minister, Dominique de Villepin, have a vision of France as standing up independently of the United States, as being, if not a superpower, at least the other power, and that they saw this as an opportunity to assert their position in those fora where they still have some importance, including the European Union and the United Nations Security Council, and that's what they did. I mean, one cannot talk to the French on background for any length of time without coming away with the sense that there was a bit of an ambush there in the Security Council in January, that they mistrusted the motives of the Bush administration, to be sure, but that they decided for their own Gaullist reasons, as well as for broader questions of statesmanship and policy, that they would ambush Colin Powell in the Security Council and start a drive to stop the war. And that's what they did. And they saw no reason to back away from that position and still see no reason to back away from that position. But there are many in France, even Gaullists and conservatives, who wonder why Chirac has taken the kind of lead in this that he has taken. And they tend to blame de Villepin, who is a wonderfully attractive, suave, debonair speaker, but is also something of a Catholic, sort of Joan of Arc, Napoleonic, Gaullist ideologue. And I think he's understood in those terms in France. So I think there's, some of this may shake out domestically in France over the next few months. But the basic position of opposition to the United States is one in which, remember, the Russians joined, and so did many little countries who were under enormous pressure from Washington and to whom enormous promises were made by Washington. And they still decided not to go against their popular sentiment and not to go against what they thought was the right thing to do.
Yes, I want to pick up something you wrote in one of your pieces about President Bush's speeches. He refers to his faith a lot in speeches. He refers to God. And you say that those religious references probably sound really different in Europe than they do in the United States. What have you been picking up on about how they sound in Europe?
Well, they sound like the words of a religious fanatic to Europeans. The Europeans don't go around. European governments, by and large, do not go around citing God as their authority to act. And no European politician, even among the Christian Democrats, comes out and talks about how he prays for guidance and how he thinks God is on his side, which is the implication of much that President Bush says. And now, whether President Bush himself feels that way, or whether he's just expressing a kind of American, you know, deeply felt American piety is another question. But the question of how it sounds to Europeans is, it sounds like the president is really almost as dangerous a fundamentalist as some Islamists. And that's an analogy that is often spoken of rather casually, rather too casually. But it's something you hear a lot of in Europe. And it's also something you hear in the Middle East. Remember, too, that in the Middle East, people react instantly to the notion of a crusade. And that a president, once he speaks certain words, cannot retract them. Nobody in the United States probably remembers that President Bush spoke of a crusade in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. And those who do remember it probably think he just didn't consider the word very carefully. But it has never been forgotten in the Middle East. It's never been forgotten in the Muslim world. And this fits directly, this war in Iraq fits directly into the context of a crusade, as far as most of the people out here are concerned.
Christopher Dickey, you're speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Do you have any intentions of going into Iraq?
Well, my intention originally in coming here was precisely to go into Iraq. But two things intervened. First of all, the Jordanians just won't let us go across the border. But the other thing that happened is that there was very quickly an understanding after the first 3 or 4 days of fighting that the approach of going in as a unilateral reporter, not embedded, not very closely associated with Allied troops, and not in under the authority of the Information Ministry in Baghdad, but just as an independent operator, was just too dangerous. Too many people got killed too quickly. Too many people nearly got killed, including a close friend of mine, Scott Johnson of Newsweek, who really came within fractions of an inch of dying. And so there was a general feeling after that it was not a good idea to go running around in Iraqi territory unless you basically were on one side or the other, which is a great shame. I mean, I think most of us who've covered wars for the last 20 years have been in situations where we were literally able to cover both sides. It was very high risk, but it was possible. Now it seems not to be possible.
Here in the United States, there's 24-hour news coverage of the war in Iraq, and a lot of people are leaving that on in the background, at least, nearly all the time. And I'm wondering, in Jordan, where you are now, is there like extensive media coverage like that? And are people transfixed by it? Is it occupying attention? And is there the same amount of moment-to-moment concern about it as there is here? And you're a lot physically closer to the war than we are here in the United States.
Well, I don't think anybody here looks at it in quite the same way, but they certainly look at it all the time. For people in this part of the world, this is not a video game. I think the overall impression of an awful lot of the coverage in the United States is that somehow it is. Whether you're watching tank cameras or you're watching all those animated presentations of helicopters and artillery pieces and missiles and bombs, there is an overall impression between the graphics and the satellite phone imagery, and not to mention the sort of aerial bombardment pictures where you sort of see this silent flash of light, that it's all somehow a video game. And people here don't watch it that way. But the more important thing to know is that, very much unlike the last Gulf War, everybody here can have, if they want it, access to CNN and to the other Western media, but they can also get access to all the Arab satellite stations, of which there are many, and which are presenting a very, very different picture of this war, including a lot more extensive briefings by the Iraqis, and an infinitely more substantial coverage of the victims of the war. So there's this sense that you get flipping back and forth between the Arab stations and the British or American stations of this kind of massive aphasia, out of where things are just wildly out of sync. And ironically, we're in a position these days, I never thought this would happen, where the briefings being given by the Iraqis are more credible on many counts than the briefings being given by the British and American briefers.
In what way?
In Qatar. You know, early on, the first week of the war, you had a situation where the British were saying, and the Americans were saying, Umm Qasr has been taken, this tiny little dump of a port in southern Iraq had been taken. And day after day, it was clear that it had not been taken, and that the pockets of resistance were, in fact, enough to stop the American control of Umm Qasr. The embedded American reporters, for security reasons, can't say what the location is where they're reporting. But the Iraqis do say what the location is where the American troops are, and it tends to be much more accurate and on the money, as it were, than what we're hearing from the Americans. You would have expected, I mean, if you covered the Arab world for any length of time, you know, one gets used to these wildly inflated numbers of we're burning all the American tanks on every front, thousands of Americans killed. We're not getting that from the Iraqis this time. We have this odd situation where, you know, the Iraqis are giving what appear to be relatively realistic numbers about their own casualties, at least civilian casualties, and about the advances of the American and British troops.
Christopher Dickey, he's Newsweek's Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief. He spoke to us from Amman, Jordan.